Hey there, it's Amy Walter, and this is a special edition of The Odd Years. Actually, it's more like a collab with the Cook Political Report's other podcast, Editor's Roundtable. If you don't know Editor's Roundtable, which, by the way, you should, it is a weekly conversation between Cook Political Report analysts where we discuss the issues, trends, individual races that we think are the most important and impactful. Think of it as an opportunity to be a fly on the wall during our editorial meetings. Check out our show notes for how you can listen to Editor's Roundtable. There are a few different ways, but the best way is to become a subscriber to the Cook Political Report. That way, you get access to Editor's Roundtable and so much more as we head into the critical midterm election. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe for more. On this Editor's Roundtable, we discuss what we've learned thus far from the primaries that have been held, and we drill down specifically on what to make of the success progressive Democrats have had over establishment candidates. Now, we recorded this last Friday before Tuesday's Colorado primary, where longtime Denver Congresswoman Diana DeGette lost a primary to a more progressive DSA-backed challenger. Here we go. Hey there, I'm Amy Walter. This is the Editor's Roundtable brought to you by the Cook Political Report. Today, I am joined by my fabulous colleagues, Aaron Covey, Jessica Taylor, Carrie Dan. Hey, guys.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, Amy.
Hey, Amy.
All right. Today, we are going to take a look. I think we are, and Aaron, you can check me on this. It feels like we're a little over halfway through primary contests when we look at the entire field of all the 435 districts that are on the ballot, about halfway through. So now is a good time to check in on what we've learned and maybe what we haven't learned yet from these primary contests. We're also going to take a sneak peek into probably the most important, at least for Democrats, Senate primary coming up, and that's in Michigan on August 4th. But before we go there, let's go backwards a second, Aaron, to New York. People in New York, especially New York City, we love them, but they like to think the world begins and ends in New York City, right? We all know that famous New Yorker cover, which was like New York as the center of the universe and everything else is just sort of out there in the hinterlands. So it's understandable that this was something of a political earthquake felt in the city, the fact that Zohran Mamdani and the Democratic Socialists were successful in three congressional races in the city. But what can what happened in New York tell us about how progressives are doing nationally and whether or not this really is, as a lot of people are calling it, a Democratic Tea Party moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think we even have to distinguish kind of within the progressive wing of the party. This is really the success of the left. So the folks who are in the squad in Congress, and there were the two members that were ousted were both technically Congressional Progressive Caucus members. Now they were less progressive than their challengers, of course. But yes, this is like a totally different universe compared to like the types of people who are often running in swing districts. Like, it just goes to show how big of a tent the Democratic Party is, because in any other country, these people would not be in the same political party. But yeah, I mean, it was a huge moment for them in New York. I think it was certainly a gamble that Mamdani took, endorsing challengers against two sitting incumbents and endorsing a candidate in an open seat who was relatively inexperienced in terms of politics, and it paid off. The open seat candidate won by like 20 points, which I think that for me was the biggest surprise of the night, Claire Valdez's margin in New York's 7th district compared to where the polls had had it before. But I think it's hard to say what this means for the rest of the country, because in New York, you really have two unique factors that are working in the left's favor. Obviously, one is the election of Zohran Mamdani and his popularity right now and his ability to you know, really boost these candidates' odds by coming in behind them. And then, of course, you have a much more organized Democratic Socialist of America Party presence in New York as well, in part thanks to kind of their own election laws in New York. There's just like a stronger, you have the Working Families Party that has always been a force in the city. And so you have like these more, I think, organized infrastructures that help the left as opposed to other areas. But I do think this certainly is going to have consequences in Democratic primaries across other urban deep blue districts. You know, we also saw a socialist candidate win the primary in Philadelphia earlier this year, Chris Rabb, who got, I believe, around 40% of the vote. So not, you know, a small majority, or not a small plurality, not a majority, but not a small plurality. And then upcoming, we're recording this podcast now on Friday, June 26th, but we have the primary in Denver next Tuesday, where the sitting Congresswoman Diana DeGette faces a really serious challenger from a candidate who is backed by the DSA as well. So it will have consequences across those districts. But to put things in perspective, right now there are, I believe, 7 members of the squad in Congress. We could see that double by the time we get to the end of this election cycle, but that's still not a huge chunk of the Democratic caucus at all.
It's not. Though, 14 members, if Democrats are in control of the House next year and they have a 10-seat majority, a 14-seat squad has a whole lot of power, right?
Certainly.
And that's what I wanted to ask. I want to sort of ask you about this too, Jess, because what we're seeing is this so-called backlash to the establishment. And there are a lot of Senate candidates on the Democratic side running against Chuck Schumer and saying, if I win, I am not going to support Chuck Schumer for leader. Do you think that there will be a push? Are there enough of these sort of candidates who could win? And then you could see a push for really regime change on the Democratic side.
I think if Democrats take back the Senate, that it's going to be on the backs of candidates like Roy Cooper, mm-hmm. and Sherrod Brown and Mary Peltola. And those are more centrist type candidates. I mean, the path to the majority does not run through, you know, the House. These are safe seats we're talking about. In these swing seats, they have gotten candidates that have got, that have not had primaries in those instances. You know, the one that we are looking ahead to is in Michigan, of course. And, you know, the only other real ideological test we had of this was in Iowa at the beginning of the month, where you had Josh Turek that was running as the establishment candidate. Now he also had $10 million in help from Vote Vets that got him over the top. It ended up not even being close with Zach Walls, who had been running against Chuck Schumer, and I kept hearing, you know, mm-hmm. this really wasn't an effective message. I think in a place like Iowa, electability matters a lot since it's such a red state. Michigan, though, is a swing state, and certainly we have seen that it has had sort of progressive, you know, lingerings, I would say. In 2016, Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton there in the primary. It's obviously swung from Trump to Biden to back to Trump in 2024. So there's a real worry if it is Abdul El-Sayed, the former Wayne and Detroit County health executive who's backed by Bernie Sanders, if he wins that nomination over the more centrist establishment, Haley Stevens. Now there's a third candidate that's fading, State Senator Mallory McMorrow. I think it just shows that they're sort of not an in-between lane. You either kind of are in the middle or you're on the far left. And she's kind of tried to be in the, you know, kind of a compromise candidate, and we've seen her really fading.
What is that line? Who had that famous line in Texas about the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead armadillos? Remember that line? That's where it sort of feels like Mallory McMorrow sort of got stuck, because you're right, Jess, she's trying to run as this Goldilocks candidate of, I'm anti-establishment, right? Like, I would vote against Chuck Schumer, and I will be, you know, standing up against the sort of status quo. But also, you guys remember, I got elected in really tough districts, so I'm electable. I'm an electable disruptor. And that doesn't feel like, maybe it would have been enough if Haley Stevens weren't already in the mix. I don't know. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think it only works if you're not in the middle.
Yeah.
Maybe you have, you're running against someone to your right or to your left if you're trying to straddle those lanes, but you can't actually be in between two other candidates who are doing well on their own.
I think there's just such a clear delineation between, and we've seen so much money come out for Stevens, you know, $22 million in ads that have already been backing her from outside groups. It's very clear. I mean, and Chuck Schumer actually said that he would be okay with either Montmorro or Stevens, but, you know, Stevens has had some ads that have come in for her. I think she's in the next few weeks and what her fundraising report looks like. You know, I'm also interested to see, you know, a candidate like Abdul Al-Sayed, what kind of money is he raising? What kind of, you know, he's not taking corporate PAC money. That's really become kind of like the shorthand in so many ways for I'm different, I'm not the establishment, I'm not going to take this corporate PAC money as well.
And you wrote this yesterday, Jess, in your piece, but it's pretty remarkable that Al-Sayed is doing as well as he is, considering that he's been outspent 17-1 on the airwaves already. And, you know, you could be a skeptical Democrat and look at like, okay, so Stevens has had $22 million spent for her, and she's still in this battle with somebody whose strength is really his ground game. And, you know, he's got the bolstering of Bernie Sanders, who has been so influential in some of these primaries, but it really speaks to the organization that he's built, that even with so little spending for him, that he's certainly holding his own, if not ahead.
I think you just have to look at where the enthusiasm is this cycle, and this is the key here, because the enthusiasm is more on the left. But some of those voters, I think the left voters in Michigan are different than voters on the left in New York City. You know, he's relying on lower propensity, younger progressives. Do those people come out in a primary? Are they motivated enough? Versus Haley Stevens still has, you know, sort of the reliable one source I talked to called it, you know, tried, tested, and true turnout mechanisms. I've long said I've kind of had August 4th circled on my calendar, because to me this is the best test in the Senate primaries, at least, of which direction the Democratic Party is going to take.
But Aaron, didn't we see in New York, you know, here are candidates running, the Democratic Socialists, as the working class candidates, right? These are the folks who are going to look out for those who are the lowest on the rungs of the economic ladder. And yet, if you look at where they got their support, most of them got support in the areas which have like higher concentration of white college graduates, right? And that the people of color or places that have lower income voters were supporting the more establishment candidate.
I think it was a little mixed. It's certainly true that the DSA-backed candidates did best in the areas that have the greatest concentration of college-educated transplants. I think it's not entirely accurate to call them like the wealthiest. This is not like, these are people who are renters. This is not New York 12.
No, this is not like the Upper West Side wealthy, but this is, but when we think of working class voters, I don't think we put people who graduated from a four-year college into that category.
That's correct. And I think that divide, it seemed a little bit starker in the 7th district, which was the open seat where Claire Valdez won. That includes Brooklyn, Queens. New York's 13th district was really interesting. That's where Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier ousted Adriano Espaillat. And that was really kind of split along ethnic lines, where like the areas that are full of folks who have recently moved to the city went for Daria Lisa by pretty wide margins. And then Espaillat, of course, did well with his base of Dominican voters in this district. And then you saw Black voters in Harlem. There's been like a couple of different analysis. There's been some different analysis of like whether or not she won them or not, but it was at least quite competitive. And some of that was due to this community's kind of long-standing frustration with Espaillat. But I think people like assumed that Cuomo was going to do better in this sort of district going into the mayoral race, and Mamdani won it by like a very healthy margin. So I think Mamdani and his coalition does definitely have like appeal with working class voters, though it varies depending on the ethnic background, the geography. So there is a little bit of nuance to that.
Yeah, and I wonder too, like a wealthy or a college-educated, well-to-do white liberal in Bushwick has good information about electability, but they're going to care about it in a very different way than a white college-educated liberal in a Tony suburb of Detroit, right? Who may be doing a lot of research into these candidates and be very concerned about, you know, they're, both of those people are equally mad at Donald Trump, but also, you know, are making, I think, more of a calculation if you're in a swing state about electability, and particularly if you're a voter with very good information, you're going to be swayed a very different way, I think, in Michigan.
Yeah, people understand the difference between the districts that they're in. And like, that's why in New York's 17th district, the most moderate candidate, Kate Conley, won by a really healthy margin. And, you know, I don't think there was ever any doubt that one of the more moderate candidates would get through, any real doubt, but there was definitely concern at different points that if the field was divided, you could see a progressive get through with like just a quarter of the vote. That obviously didn't happen. And I think what also is a dynamic in all of these swing seats is typically the more moderate candidate is set up with the resources, both from with their own campaign and from the outside, to do well in these primaries, because folks in Washington know that they're the best position to win the general election. So from the beginning, you know, I think she was going to be in a good position because of that.
And I think a difference in Michigan too is, you know, in Iowa, of course, you had such heavy spending on behalf of Josh Turek, but Josh Turek had a really interesting story. He's in a wheelchair. He is a Paralympian. You know, he had a very compelling story about winning in purple areas and red areas. And, you know, Haley Stevens, she's an awkward candidate. I think, you know, there's some backlash to her from AIPAC, of course, as we've seen in so many of these other races. I think, you know, we're not talking about, you know, the way that Alyssa Slotkin last cycle was able to effectively clear the Democratic field. You know, I think there's some questions that people just have about Haley Stevens as a candidate as well, that is also playing into this race. Whereas, you know, even I had people tell me, you know, Abdul is charismatic and he's running kind of a good digital operation. He had an ad out this morning that as a millennial, he was like, with the absentee ballots that went out on Thursday, it was like a Blue's Clues themed thing. And I was like, oh, this is really kind of cute and creative. So I think he's playing well into sort of that digital space as well. That I don't see Stevens doing as much in.
So, Terry, one thing I hear a lot from my Democratic sources is this worry that Democrats are going to learn the wrong lessons from the midterms. It's that they're going to look at the success of some of these more progressive candidates or the ones who are running on defunding ICE, et cetera, and say, oh, well, this is where our party's going and I need to run like that in order to win the nomination in 2028. What's your sense of the ways in which folks who are either clearly running for president or thinking about running for president are managing this? I mean, I've seen, for example, Governor Shapiro come out and kind of push back a little bit on the DSA is the Democratic Party, but where else are you looking for ways in which or where have you seen perhaps Democrats with a national profile reacting to this?
Well, one thing I think is really interesting is there isn't really, outside of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there isn't a clear progressive lane for 2028 with, if you are making the, I think, reasonable assumption that AOC probably has her eyes on Schumer's seat and maybe running for the United States Senate rather than in 2028. Obviously, if she's running in 2028, I think that's where the all of the energy of the progressive wing of the party goes. But if she's not there, I'm not sure what other person steps in to fill that void. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren.
I guess it's Ro Khanna.
Yeah.
Ro Khanna is setting himself up as that guy. I mean, he's everywhere. And he seems to be leaning in on that. But it's like, I guess the question is, will anybody else who's not named Ro Khanna decide
right.
that that's the lane they need to go into? Like watching Chris Van Hollen, for example.
I was just about to mention that, yeah.
I also think there's going to be people like Pritzker, for example, or even Newsom, who are kind of trying to scramble those ideological divides a little bit. Like, particularly on the issue of Israel, these governors, a lot of the governors haven't ever taken money from AIPAC because it's just less embedded into the infrastructure as it is in Congress. And so I think they're going to be running on that and trying to kind of like win over credibility from progressives in that way. So I'll be curious who kind of tries to rebrand themselves maybe a little bit as a progressive. We're certainly seeing like Chris Van Hollen do this right now. And even like a Chris Murphy has been a bit more critical of the establishment than others.
And there's the question of, do they overlearn the lessons of the midterms, or are the, do they still have Democratic PTSD from 2024 and Kamala Harris and look back at the last presidential election and say, whatever we're going to do, it has to be not that, because the stakes are so high. And they, the lesson learned from that was that the, you know, assuming that Kamala Harris was going to be able to get over the finish line was the wrong assumption to make, both ideologically and, you know, with the change of the driver's seat at the last minute in 2024. Yeah.
I think that Democrats could very well draw too many lessons, the wrong lessons from 2024, from 2026, from some of these primaries in the way that they did in 2022, that Biden, you know, I think one of his fatal mistakes was that he saw that as a validation of his presidency when in fact it was weak Republican candidates. It was the Dobbs decision. I'm not sure that the Democratic Party writ large is going to be thinking back to 2024. I think there's a real danger that they sort of overdraw lessons from the midterms and from 2026 and from these types of candidates.
It also depends on what happens in Michigan and Maine, yeah. right? If El-Sayed wins the primary and loses the general, or wins the primary and wins the general, those are very different lessons to be drawn. Same with Graham Platner, right?
Yeah.
If Democrats end up fumbling these seats, then maybe the Democratic candidates for 2028 draw on that as a cautionary tale.
And to be clear, I mean, there's El-Sayed could win the general. Graham Platner could win the general just because the environment is so bad for Democrats. I mean, Maine is a very different state than Michigan. But, you know, even if El-Sayed wins the primary, I think it would be a tougher race than it would if it's Stevens. But I think it's still a toss-up race.
Yeah, and I think Graham Platner's problems are much more personal than they are ideological.
Yeah.
Whereas El-Sayed, it would be a clearer debate over ideology. Right.
Yeah.
How far left do we want to go?
Those are all good points. I think also in the House, you're seeing some candidates like Rebecca Cook in Wisconsin, Bob Brooks in Pennsylvania, Brian Poindexter in Ohio, who have secured endorsements from both Bernie and the Blue Dogs and are kind of trying to do this like economic populist thing while not running as far left on the social issues. So I wonder like how many and which potential presidential hopefuls will do that in 2028. Because
that seems like the secret sauce, right? For Democratic primary.
Yeah, I think all three of those candidates have the potential to perform well. And we'll see how many other folks try to position themselves similarly over the next couple of months.
Before we close here, just want to get any other takes. Well, actually, Jess, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball here.
great.
On one thing, which was the one thing that stuck out, and maybe this can be a new feature of our editor's roundtable, is what stuck out to you this week that you're like, huh, that is really interesting, and about the upcoming election. And to me, it was the AARP poll in Ohio that is done by Republican Tony Fabrizio, obviously Donald Trump's pollster, Democrat John Anzalone, who was Biden's pollster. I'm not saying these guys are perfect or that they're, you know, they have this exactly right. But the fact that this poll in Ohio not only showed Sherrod Brown ahead, but showed the generic ballot in a state Trump carried by 10 at D+3, that to me suggests that this environment is more problematic for Republicans than maybe they're even I know they're taking it seriously, but it seems like, wow, this is a much more dangerous environment for Republicans than even some of the worst case scenarios had expected.
What stuck out to me about that poll is that Husted and Republicans are tracking so close to Trump's approval numbers.
Yeah,
I think it's just going to be hard for a Republican to overperform where Trump is, in the same way that it was, you know, we typically see what Democrats are getting was very close to the Biden or the Harris number. I think this is going to be, you know, in our polling that we did earlier this year, with the House battleground poll that you all did, what stuck out to me there was that you're seeing, you know, Republicans try to continue to blame Biden and say Trump inherited this economy. But in our poll, it clearly showed that voters are blaming Trump for this. They're blaming, you know, they have points that go back to Iran, to the beginning of the Iran war. And I guess the other thing that I feel like we're still in limbo about is this memorandum of understanding. And, you know, by the time this airs, who knows where we'll be with Iran and the Strait of Hormuz and everything. But it's in such flux. And I just wonder whether, even if gas prices are going down, are people still going to remember that it was tied exactly to the major uptick that we've seen was tied to the war that was so unpopular.
Well, I talked to a Democrat the other day who gave me a great quote when they said, look, July 4th is the point of no return in an election. Once July 4th happened, forget about Labor Day, it's July 4th, opinions about the president or about the environment, those are set in stone. You're not going to change much of the political environment between July 4th and the election. But to your point, Jess, can you get, once we get into a place like Ohio, can the president just get closer to 50 among the electorate in that state, right? He doesn't need to get more popular nationally, but can he get just back to even just 50% or 49% approval rating in that state? And that's the number to watch.
Well, and it also seems like a lot of the Republicans pollsters that you and I, Amy, have talked to will say, we have lots of good stuff to run on. We can run on economic policy that actually individual pieces of the One Big Beautiful Bill are popular. We can run on border security. Yes, we can run on sort of the DEI woke issues. But what we can't do is have Donald Trump be in front of everybody all the time, because he distracts from those messages and in large part doesn't even go out of his way to highlight his administration's own accomplishments that are popular.
Right.
And just this week, he said, he threw a temper tantrum and said, I'm not going to sign this housing bill that was bipartisan, that Republicans were, when voters are saying we care about affordability, this is something that would have addressed this. And instead, he's more worried about the SAVE Act that has no path to getting 60 votes in the Senate.
Right. If he can't get out of his own way, it's hard to see a rebound in that popularity, even in red states.
It may likely come at the expense of Democrats. Hoping to make Democrats less popular might make the president look a little more popular.
They're already pretty unpopular, so.
I know. Well, let's leave it there, because we're going to have a lot more of this kind of conversation for, well, pretty much the next few months. We'll be tracking all of this, talking about all of this. We're going to have so much great stuff for you as we head into the midterms this summer and fall. You don't want to miss it. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.